Welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, sophisticated persuasion training, education for a complicated modern world. It's nuts out there. We need better ideas. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, stand-up comic, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Here on the podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their careers in politics. Always interesting to hear what their brains come up with. I convert conservatives from time to time because the right worries me. I think they are a little bit off the Democratic rails, so I drag them back. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. This podcast has more rhetoricians than any other podcast you will listen to today. I can almost promise that. Today is another episode of Persuasion Pros and Rhetoricians. My guest is a younger gun in the rhetoric game. He's been a research associate at the IC2 Institute in Austin. Has worked in the business trenches as a communication coach. He's now a COO at Code 4 Emergency Services, a company that keeps concerts safe. We talked about this before. It's really a very interesting business. Jonathan Alba. Jonathan, what's up?
Just a sunny day in Austin, and I have a big smile on my face for the number of times I heard the word rhetorician. So, rhetoric was my first love. I'm a student of communication studies and focus heavily on rhetoric. So I throw that out there. And I heard your podcast, you're having a conversation with Art Markman, who I worked for at IC Squared. And I said, I got to meet Dan. He seems really cool. And so I'm grateful that we're able to connect today and talk about the world of event safety, research, rhetoric, and business. How do those all intersect? So,
yeah, that's the thing I've always really liked about rhetoric. It gets in everywhere. I mean, it literally exists in every single sector of human experience because you're always talking and you're always trying to get things accomplished with words. So you can study whatever you want in rhetoric.
I was trying to get on your podcast. I was using rhetoric the first time I messaged you. So I wanted to have a conversation with you. So
you nailed it.
Yeah, my rhetoric worked.
Just like that. So you went to school at Texas State. Is that right?
I did. Yes. That was the one school that would have me. I was a community college. I'm born and raised in Austin, Texas. And I started my academic journey at ACC, the community college here in Austin. Really without knowing what I wanted to do in life. I somehow transferred to Texas State by the grace of God and kind of wandered around there for a little bit, thought I wanted to study sports science first. Sports were a big part of my life growing up. Moved over to mass communication. Didn't really like that. It wasn't juicy enough. It wasn't enough intellectual stimulation. Dabbled in the business school, and then ultimately a guidance counselor introduced me to communication studies. It was just a lucky encounter. She said, hey, it looks like you like communication. You probably want to graduate soon. Why don't you try this communication studies program? It's really, really good. And so I trusted her. And the first class I had, Dan, was rhetorical methods. Dr. Rebecca Fox, who got her PhD at Purdue. And I was instantly, it was like that. I was connected with her as a summer school class. All the students were asleep and I felt just a joy going there every day and just having this intellectual banter with her. And she taught me a new way to see the world. So that's how I discovered rhetoric. And since I found communication studies, I went to grad school for it. And it's driving passion in my life, rhetoric and communication.
Yeah, I think a lot of people come to communication obliquely like that because it's not one of those academic areas that people think of. Like even when they find out I have a PhD in rhetoric, 80% of people don't believe it's real. Like, what is that? That's not a real. I'm like, yeah, turns out it's one of the oldest degrees there is.
Yeah, it's from medieval times.
So there's a certain learning curve for when people first encounter it and like what you can study how people communicate in relationships and public and persuasion, all these things. And so it does. In some ways, it could probably advertise itself a lot better, but.
Oh, yeah. So our Texas State has a humongous challenge. I think, you know, 100 students sign up for a communication studies degree. And I'm always scratching my head. It's like, hey, we're the rhetoricians. We're the communication college, and yet we struggle to communicate about, you know, the importance, the value of our degree. And so I never got that. Yeah, most students, you know, have an experience with a professor, say, I like that, what he was teaching, I want to learn more. And so really we're out there selling when we're teaching. I'm curious how you found your way to rhetoric as well.
Well, I think rhetoric in general as a field is still mostly theoretical. It's mostly academic, and therefore they don't apply their own principles into their own work. Some of them do, but it's not one of those things where people look at it the way like in advertising or marketing that has direct application to an activity, you know, within an industry. And so I find a lot of rhetoricians don't know how to promote themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't promote themselves. Like even just starting this podcast, there's only Jennifer Machia and, you know, I don't know who else, a couple other people here and there that do a little bit of rhetoric in the public realm, a little bit of rhetoric training. So it's still very rare, which if you understand the, you know, what academics are and who they are, kind of makes sense. You know, yes. They tend to look at the world, but not get in the world.
Right. Well, you dabbled with it more than I was actually had a decision to make of go get a PhD or not. And ultimately joining the business world. I mean, I'm curious. We talked a little bit about your teaching experience in our first conversation. What led you to leave the academic world?
Well, I was the opposite of most academics. I like academics a lot. I like the intellectual sphere, you know, where you can go in there and just read and talk and study and write. And I appreciate that for what it is and what it yields, but I'm never satisfied there. Yeah. I have to go out into the world to drag this stuff over and either teach it or use it. And for the first 15, 20 years I was in this outside of grad school, I combined those things. I was a professor, but I was also an active rhetorician, and then I was a journalist writer, and I was a stand-up comic, and eventually I started working for businesses. So I've always moved out of the bubble into the actual use of these things. And so teaching for me was super fun, but ultimately it just wasn't satisfying to just do that. I wanted to get out and mix it up. And I still do. And that's why this podcast, in some ways, the last 2 years of getting this podcast up and going and the idea of a Rhetoric Training for America project, it is still that same thing. We absolutely need better training to handle the complexity of modern, especially politics. And I want to get in there and do it, mix it up.
Well, I think you are. That's why it's such a joy to talk with you and watch your, be an observer of your work. And it's interesting. I was filling out a survey. We hired a communication specialist at Code 4. And one of the questions she was asking as she's going over and writing staff bios is, what did you want to be when you were growing up? And my answer was a stand-up comedian. And teaching and rhetoric has allowed me to do that. You know, Dan, some days I just feel like a hopeless comic up there talking to employees, or when I was, you know, teaching communication, just doing the dance of trying to make this fun and entertaining. So, how did you get into stand-up comedy?
Well, I think that entertainment, you know, has become such a dominant force in our public discourse. It's always been there, but especially with media and what that's done to American culture and world culture, you have to be able to entertain. Everybody's trained to it. Nobody can handle boredom at all anymore. You know, they will shut you down. Their brains will just jump out of their heads and run away. So you've got to do some of that stuff. Either you have to be super dramatic, or like Trump, you have to be super conflict. It's all drama, all, you know, tragedy and trauma all the time. You have to do that stuff to keep people focused. Comedy to me is just the most natural one to me. Like I my brain does it easily. And so it was just there. Stand-up is an easy occupation to get into. You can go up to open mic nights tonight. Jonathan, I don't know if you've ever done stand-up, but you could go tonight in Austin. There's probably five open mics and start your career. So
got on stage once. I will get on stage again before not too long. as I've developed, you know, more communication skills and storytelling abilities. And it used to frighten me. I failed my first public speaking class, Dan.
Really? You failed the class?
I failed multiple classes. I used to tell students I was on the dean's list, academic probation, and suspension. So I don't care where you're at, you could come talk to me. Yeah, it took me a long time to figure out, you know, what I loved and you know, find the professors who would kind of help put the fertile ground underneath me so that I could grow. Yeah, the first public speaking class I was in, I wanted to be cute and give a talk about healthy masturbation. And really that was, you know, the young comic trying to come out and—
Sure, why not?
Everyone was, you know, giggling and laughing, and inside I was feeling terrified. And so when it came time to speak, I just stopped showing up. I didn't go.
You didn't fail the class. You ejected the class.
Yes. I was terrified of getting up in front of people and speaking. The next experience I had with a wonderful teacher, she invited me to research topics that I cared about. And so I looked at introversion and extroversion and meditation. That's actually when I started to develop a meditation practice in undergrad. Started to realize that nervous energy was excitement. Ended up competing speaking festivals and going up against, you know, debaters, and then worked with national champion debaters to train me in how to speak rather rapidly and quickly. What do they call it? Impromptu speaking became just a part of who I am. So yeah, it wasn't easy. Most people think, you know, they watch a comedian on stage or someone giving a speech, it's really, really polished. It's years of work and a lot of failure, honestly.
Yeah, and stand up, there's an old adage in stand up, but it takes 10 years to get good at it. You know, and that's working full time. That's for full time professional comics who are going to clubs 40 weeks a year. There's these ascension levels that you don't really understand as an audience member. You just know when people are there, you know, and once they've gotten there, then it becomes this art of trying to stay there. And I see a lot of master comics who have gotten to a certain point and they don't know where to go from there, and they repeat themselves, and then they start to lose their ear because they're too popular, and they just lose it.
Yeah, I feel this kind of the same sense with musicians, right? Like the early albums or the hits, because they're dealing with their pain and they're transforming that into their art. And that's why I've always been fascinated with Chappelle. I've seen him a handful of times, and it's almost like watching a jazz musician. Yeah. He's out there living life. You've also written for a ton of comedians. So there's also hired help that, you know, they can get as well.
If they start to take advantage of all the people that are really, really good at things around them, you know, they put together teams, and most great rhetoric of any type is done by a team. Like, it doesn't matter if the one person up there seems like, oh, it's like Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. When you actually go back and study it, like the whole better angels of our nature and thing, he took that from somewhere else. Like that was already written somewhere else and he adapted it to his speech. There's all sorts of things going on behind the scenes of great messaging that people don't ever know. And that is sort of one of the magic offers of rhetoric. It's like, yeah, you want to build great messages. Turns out there's this whole architecture over here you need to know about in order to do that.
I'm smiling because one of my favorite things in studying rhetoric was looking at speeches, American speeches, or that was a class of ours, or just presidential addresses. And you're so right. Like, all the messages are already out there. Like, how do we, you know, fold them into our own messages? It's a completely lost. That's a beautiful, beautiful thought. Because oftentimes when writing a speech, I'm thinking that I have to create something from scratch. And then my best speeches or jumping off points are, you know, from something that someone's already said.
Well, art, you know, other forms of art don't do that. Painting always grows from previous painting. Everybody, you learn all this stuff and you make small variations, and suddenly enough variation makes it seem new and different. But it always has things that are informing what you're doing. And messaging is the same way. Again, I think because people communicate normally as human beings every day in their life, they tend to mundane it. You know, they'll be like, it's just communication. I'm like, yeah. That is so true.
On a rant.
Have you ever tried to do really great communication? Because that's different.
So I have a good friend that has an example in his book of, you know, when the college wants to do a communication campaign or a marketing campaign, they'll throw that to a student class. And, you know, you would never do that if you wanted to build a building. You're not going to go get the engineering class, you know, to construct it. And so we, you know, say we value it. Do we really value communication and you know, rhetoric? It's, oh, we'll throw that to the, that's a student project. Oh, it's presented some challenges in my life.
You know, when people, business is a good example of this, and persuasion works for it too. And even comedy, like when I taught comedy classes, I've taught workshops at tons of different comedy clubs. And when I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, there was a great comedy club called Charlie Goodnights. And they wanted to vet people before they'd let them on to the open mic, because it's a really, you know, classy club at the time. And so they wanted people to audition. So I would audition people and I would tell them, okay, well, that I wouldn't do that and that and that because it won't work. And they'd be like, yeah, you know, comedians don't want to listen to anybody, which is part of their superpower.
Sure.
And so they'd be like, yeah, yeah. And then they'd go up and do it and it wouldn't work. But you got that instant proof that your expertise was correct. And then they just submitted. They're like, well, you know, I don't. I'm like, yeah, there you go. That's a good system.
It's the same way with teaching public speaking. They'd always, usually they were the older students. They'd come up to me and say, I got this. I don't need to practice that. Trust me, I'll wing it. And then afterwards, it's, you know, they're stumbling and bumbling and I didn't have to say anything. Like, yeah, I should have listened to you. What do you want me to do, you know, next time? So it's part of the human condition.
Which I think is great. You know, when you have a reason to learn, failure gives you a reason to learn versus this abstract, I'm just here taking a class. Now it's, oh, if I don't do this well, I'm going to suffer or I'm not going to get this job. You know, that kind of super motivated learning is way, way better than what academics starts from, which is dump kids into, you know, college for 4 years and just say, hey, this is a good class for you. And they're like, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's what I felt like when I felt a sense of joy and relief when I found communication. It's like, here's a discipline that can train me to do all the things that I'm not super skilled at. Like, I want to be able to work together with other people. I want to be able to stand up and deliver a presentation or a speech. And I want to be able to write and write compellingly and tell stories. And so I had this, yeah, real deep motivation to learn. I just didn't know that discipline existed. So again, I'll come back to it. I don't know if I know, like, how did you discover rhetoric? Because it's not an easy thing to discover.
So I had just as an oblique entrance as you did, probably more so in some ways. I was an English and journalism undergrad. And so I took communication courses, but they were the easy courses, you know, and most of the people in them I always thought were kind of stupid. But one professor I had, I never took any rhetoric at all. I took public speaking. That was the only thing I ever took. I never even took persuasion. And I remember seeing it and thinking I'd like to take that, but I never did. But I took some communication studies courses that I really liked. And there was a young professor and I stopped into his office one day. I was already working as a writer. I was already doing PR writing and technical writing while I was in college. And I'm like, I hate these jobs. I don't want to be a journalist. It's all restricted writing. It's so, you know, forced into a certain format. I hate it. And I'm like, what am I going to do for a job? What do I do next? And he's like, go to grad school. Yep. And I was first generation college student. I didn't even know what grad school was. And he's like, I'm like, what's that? He's like, okay. So he sent away for grad school applications. And I got in at Wisconsin, Madison, Purdue, Northwestern, and UT Austin. And that's an easy choice because only one of those is warm. And so I showed up. I showed up at UT and Rod Hart was the chair of the department at that time. And I was there 2 weeks before classes started. I hadn't signed up for anything yet. And I went in to see him to meet the chair and I was asking and he's like, well, what are you here to study? And I'm like, I don't know.
Professors love that answer.
I'm like, what do you got? And, and he laughed at me and I'm like, what do you do? And he said, I teach rhetoric. I'm like, cool word. What's that mean? And he laughed at me again. And he asked, he goes, well, do you know Judith? I can't remember her last name. Did you take classes from this person at Dayton where I went to school? And I'm like, no, I never took classes from her. He goes, well, she's really good in rhetoric and known in the field. That would have helped you. And I'm like, no, I didn't do that. He goes, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make you my teaching assistant. And so I was his teaching assistant in the large persuasion course first semester. And wow. Instantly was like, oh, this stuff is awesome. There's so much depth to it, so much philosophy and linguistics and application. So I was like, I'm in.
That's awesome. Yeah, it incorporates so much. It's so fascinating. I try to tell students all the time, like, go talk to your professors. Like, that's the gateway to whatever it is you want to do. Just go talk to them. That sounds like a pretty special experience.
So how did you get from undergrad over to IC Squared or so, master's?
Yeah, I had actually created my, I was working at the fire marshal's office, kind of as their communication specialist. And I created a position for myself that ultimately didn't pan out. It was a bit of a letdown. And so I was like, what am I going to do next? And I didn't know. And so literally I was playing computer games one day and I met a friend online and introduced me to Evan Stein is his name. He was a PhD student. I said, hey, what's going on? But he's like, I'm grading papers. I said, what are you grading? I used to teach. He said, for HDO. I said, oh, that's arts program. He said, how do you know that? Art's my, you know, professor. He's my PhD advisor. I said, I've always wanted to meet him. I've read his books and, you know, I've always been a fan for a long time. He said, well, email him. So, okay. You know, I emailed Art and he said, yeah, let's meet. Art actually knows my uncle as well. There's some family connections. And so silly me thought I'm going to walk into Art's office and I'm going to go be his PhD student. Much like your story. Like I thought that's how it worked.
Yeah. People don't know.
Yeah. Little did I know, like people all over the world email this guy that want to come study. And it was super cool. He has his show, Two Guys on Your Head. It was almost like that episode. And he said, you know what, Jonathan, if you want to get your PhD, volunteer in a lab and start to learn the lingo and that'll, you know, beef up your resume, your application. So the second that meeting was over, I went and had Torchy's Tacos with Evan. And he said, you know, I need some help in the lab. Do you want to volunteer? And I said, I don't have anything else going on. So let's do it. He was about 7 years into his PhD and really struggling to just, he needed a collaborator. And he needed some help. And so I knew how to, you know, train people. I knew how to conduct research. And honestly, I know how to work with visionary people who have this idea in their head, they need to get it out. And so I just started to help Evan and basically just be his research assistant. And through that, I got really access to Art. And I worked as a volunteer literally for food. I took unemployment and Evan bought me lunch and I showed up, you know, first one to show up in the lab and do the work. And so we designed experiments on how teams make decisions under pressure. And we started to use video games to do that. And me, like kindred spirit, Dan, it has to be applied. How the hell does this work in the real world? So I start reaching out to the fire marshal's office. I start reaching out to hostage negotiators, you know, SWAT, and I'm going into the field to get their feedback on how they make decisions under pressure and talking to them about our research and that's informing it. So much fun.
Yeah.
Once Evan starts running his project and I can kind of let that go and, you know, it's easy for him. And we have a whole lab now. We have, you know, seven undergrads running experiments like clockwork. He has confidence in himself. He's not feeling crazy. I start to look for other opportunities. And by that time we had sought out funding from IC Squared. That's where Greg Pogue kind of comes into the future and or into the picture. And we started studying how they're training entrepreneurs. So Art, I needed to earn a living or have some money coming in. So Art said, go talk to Greg. You know, IC Squared is always funding projects. So Art and I started to collaborate on projects. One of the projects that I hit on ultimately was this group out of North Dakota called Emerging Prairie. Kind of skipping around, but they're kind of doing something really special. So there was a professor of mine, Michael Burns, who's really an applied persuasion researcher at Texas State. He'd be a great person on this podcast. He's actually worked the last six Olympics for the Today Show. Oh, they cool. call him in to run logistics. talk about doing applied work. Anyway, he said, call Greg up there in Fargo. They've got something going on and you're researching entrepreneurship. So I started this research project looking into how small towns are creating entrepreneurial cultures and new economic opportunities for companies and people. And so IC Squared was the seed funding for that project. I had to go ask Greg for $20,000, $30,000, I think, you know, two or three semesters in a row. He was mean in a kind way, but he made me ask for what I wanted. And so it became this really beautiful collaboration between IC Squared and art. So, you know, about a year and a half in, I'm like, well, what am I going to do with my life? Is this going to be a thing or, you know, what? I expanded the research to New Hampshire. There's a small community called Keene, New Hampshire, that has a wonderful story of entrepreneurship that kind of hit the decline and they're thinking about what's next. And so we had a nice little comparison between the two. And I was living in New Hampshire for about a month, month and a half. And I got an email that I need to come back. Art is now taking
over.
There's
a rhetoric emergency. Rhetoric is breaking.
Yes. Art is taking over as the chair of IC Squared. And I said, okay, what does that mean? I'm like, ugh.
Change.
And so I went back and I said, well, what does this mean? And what's the focus going to be? And he said, rural entrepreneurship. I said, what are you shitting me? Like, what? He's like, yeah, the work that you're doing, it's like that's going to be the new mission of the Institute. And I said, well, damn. and so that led to a full-time opportunity as a research associate at IC Squared, where that is a historic story in and of itself. I'm curious if you know much about IC Squared, Dan. And before getting into that, that led to working with, you know, Art and Greg, or my two academic superheroes, for the better half of 2 years, traveling the world and researching economic development and entrepreneurship in small communities.
Yeah, what a great opportunity that is.
Yeah. Yeah. So as an Austinite, I mean, I had no idea what IC Squared is or was. It just was this, I found the perfect place for me because it was about applied research and building programs and doing things.
Right.
So IC Squared was founded by George Kosmetsky. He was the old business school dean. I think he took over in like late 60s or so. He founded IC Squared in 1977. So before I started Christmas break, you know, I love reading. I just picked up his biography and I read it, the whole thing. Incredible story. Incredible story. World War II veteran, Harvard PhD, goes out to California, starts a company, successful entrepreneur. UT taps him to be the business school dean. He comes over and sees Austin is just ripe for this economic development that he's seen out in California. And so he created IC Squared to be the catalyst for his vision. And he literally planned most of what we see today in Austin out. It was like drawn out on a napkin. His original drawings are on a chalkboard in Greg's office still to this day. It gives me goosebumps. So he started the Austin Technology Incubator there, the global group. I mean, just hit after hit after hit. And he really used it. He mentored Michael Dell. He used it as his way to bring together government, private industry, and academia to essentially accomplish his vision of Austin being this technopolis, which we're living in today. Most people have no clue that it was thought out and deliberate.
Zero clue. I mean, I've lived there off and on for 20 years, and I'd never even heard his name. I've never heard of any of this. IC2 Squared, I literally just wandered into because a friend of mine, a rhetorician, emailed me and said, hey, you should talk to Art Markman. He does little media, you know, things on NPR or whatever the public radio is. And he, you should talk to him. So I just emailed him and we ended up doing this. And so all this is completely new to me, even though I've been right there, probably, you know, 5 miles from that place for years and years.
Well, a special place dear to my heart, because it hits on the things that I value, which is collaboration. And IC Squared, we were able to bring in, I mean, on our team was an economist, We had a mathematician. Greg is a molecular biologist who's also a serial entrepreneur that most people don't know. He's, you know, run five companies, developing vaccines on the weekend. He's a mad, literally a mad scientist. I got to introduce you to him because his wife is a comm studies teacher. She now does accounting. When I discovered him and his teachings and how he was teaching entrepreneurs, he was teaching rhetoric to entrepreneurs. He was teaching Aristotle to entrepreneurs. And I just like, wow, I was in like academic heaven. There's just so much intellectual thought and multidisciplinary, and then the ability to actually, you know, make an impact, because our work was supposed to do something in the world. So it was a really cool experience in a special place. Art has since moved on, and it was really fun to work in a startup academic environment and get that experience, which is very different from working in a research lab.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in talking to you more about that. I when I talked to Art, this is one of the things I pinged him on a little bit, was like, so much of the university, especially UT Austin, is an amazing place. There's so much going on over there. And again, it's so little of it seems to actually transcend that orb of the university. Nobody knows all these things that are happening. Right. And it drives me a little crazy, which is, again, one of the reasons why I moved back to California. This idea of starting an ethical rhetoric institute to train people how to do ethical only rhetoric, so that if we literally just had that technology, that software for, hey, these techniques of persuasion are not allowed in our politics, we'd be perfectly fine.
Sure.
It doesn't matter how conservative you are, or liberal, or any of that stuff. What matters is how you persuade. Mm. If you're using deception, if you're using slander, if you're using all these, you know, unethical techniques, you're in bad land. That's a bad land for America, because it destroys the ability to trust public discourse.
Right.
And to me, like, being able to teach people that, so that they have very mechanical ways of judging the public discourse, as opposed to, oh, I just think you're a bad person, you're a liar, right, and all this. You can clean up mechanics. You can't clean up, morals. Like, you can't do it. You can take mechanical activity and go, that one, no, not allowed. That's punished in this way if you use this.
So who do you want to train first? Like, because one thing, though, about being a rhetorician is that I can't turn it off. And so going out or reading things with me becomes no fun. I'm the, you know, the pessimistic guy that's always looking at the power and the message. So
go to a stand-up comedy show with a comic sometime if you want to really not enjoy somebody sitting at the table.
You know, I heard it's pretty bad.
You don't laugh. Like, even the really good jokes you'll appreciate.
Right.
You know? Every once in a while, there are some comics that make me laugh, but it's so rare. So I tell people, I can't sit at a table with you while you, because I want you to experience it. I want you to enjoy it. And they keep looking at me and I'm like, eh. You know,
it's okay. I mean, a gift and a curse. People send me all their, you know, emails and Slack messages at work to analyze it. And I'm, you know, sitting and combing through language. It's the life of a rhetorician. I'm curious though, like, that's, I wish that these tools were available to me earlier and sooner. There's two mindsets or skill sets that I'll say that I found vital to my success in my life. And one is rhetoric, the other is entrepreneurship. So I don't know how to be the cheerleader for it or how to get it out. Where do we start teaching rhetoric, or where's your first avenue?
Well, I taught it in universities for a long time, and I got really tired of teaching 18 and 20 year olds. It's not really the time in their life when they're ready for it. Not many people end up arrive as motivated as you ended up being to learn that stuff. So you end up hitting them in the head with ping pong balls that just bounce off. And I'm like, nah, this is not my game. And I think, like, when I work for businesses, there's a clear need. Businesses need messaging that get them things, that get them customers, that get them sales, that get them, they have a direct need for messaging that works.
Yes.
And so rhetoric makes sense there. But on the other hand, their resources and their are so limited about time and attention and speed, and that you can't do great rhetoric under intense speed pressure conditions. The reality of rhetorical builds is that they're very complicated. They go off the rails. They miss the targets very easily. Like we just built, I had a meeting last night where I'm building out personas for a new business. And I tend to build like really hyper-developed targets. And I write narratives about them, characters. I'm like, these are the people you're trying to talk to. And if you were talking to a four-year-old right there, you would adjust all your messaging to work with that four-year-old. This is the same process. So don't get away from that person. So to do that kind of rhetorical training with business, you can't educate them. You can't spend all your time educating them, which ends up driving you nuts. So you have to just do it and then letting them see the results, and they can point and choose, because that's really what businesses want.
Yes. And my role now, Dan, give me two options. I don't need education. Like I need it today. I'm in a different arena than I was where I could, spend 6 months developing a project or, researching to hours on end. It's, and to your point, businesses and especially marketers and salespeople, I believe need those skills. And that's when, someone tells me they're a mass comm major, like, oh, you're the evil major. And they don't get the depth of learning and knowledge that rhetoricians possess. So I think that's a wonderful audience, and that we need it as an organization. And I know so many businesses struggle with messaging.
Yeah. And because I was trained as an academic for so long, and I can't turn it off, like you were saying, I will go behind the scenes and do all the work to build an infrastructure that makes it fast. And that's kind of what I've done for the 500 Rockets Digital Agency that you were talking about earlier before we started the call, is that when somebody walks in now, I've got, basically an array of things that have to be filled in for that business. And I've got processes for each one. So nice. If they need a name, I'm like, great. Here's the exact process I'm going to take you through. Here's how long it's going to take. You're going to get a bank of names. 10 of them are going to be great. And you're going to pick one and we're done. And they're like, I'm like, there can be no slippage in this process because you will not get finished and you will not get a good product. But it has to be locked down like that. I can't take them through it. My partner sometimes has taken people through the architecture I've built and they're just like, I can't stay here. It's too much to absorb that fast.
Yeah. That's a huge challenge. I love to hear that you have a process. That's one thing that I always look for when working with another company or a coach, is do they have a documented process that they can take us to? Because to me, that signals that they've thought something through and that they can also move quicker. So that's wonderful. I'd love to check that out. This sounds really, really useful.
I'm working for a company right now that's working to create basically the greatest library of stand-up comedy that you can access for $5 a month. They went to a streaming service where they collect all the stand-up from 1,000 stand-ups. They organize it $5 a month. You can watch as much as you want. So that's the business plan. What they don't understand is just how complicated the world of stand-up comedy is. There are a million people, I don't know, in America trying stand-up in some way.
Yeah.
How do you organize all that? And I told them, I'm like, you guys are talking about 40 different chess games with different pieces all moving at the same time, but you haven't graphed it. So let's graph it. Let's graph all the ways you can organize stand-up. And then you can just pick things out of there and go, oh, let's develop this one. But that intellectual backbone for everything that you've been trained to do, like you said, you've got time to do that in an institute or a research institution. But it still has to be taken out and translated into somebody who actively needs it so that they can use it. They can't go through it all back with you.
Right.
Just be like, and that's why I typically do point and choose work with businesses. I'm like, you don't care about how long it's took me. I'm going to give you three choices.
please teach other consultants this method, because it would, I'd love it. And it sounds like you're doing a lot of integrator work, which is kind of the term from Traction, which is working with visionary people or companies and like, hey, let's get this down on paper so we can make the vision a reality, which is often the case, I find, in working with visionary entrepreneurs. So you have a tall task ahead of you.
It is. Well, there's an interesting term from Kenneth Burke he was great at creating phrases, but the phrase of the bureaucratization of the imagination.
Ooh.
Of taking things from the imaginary abstract into the concrete, that bureaucracy is what kills it. You have to have it to translate it down here, but it's so lethal to the original idea that you need somebody controlling that process so it doesn't allow that idea to die. It doesn't allow the toxicity to destroy the idea so that you end up with something over here that's concrete and in the world, but boring and not what it was originally supposed to be.
That's what we're dealing with at Code 4. Literally, we've grown so much and now we have to have process, and some folks don't enjoy that because it was living. I just have to mad shout out to Kenneth Burke quote. That's my rhetoric professor was a Burkean. And so I've read way too much Burke in my life and really grateful for it. You're exactly right, though. It like there has to be bureaucracy now. Working in academic institutions are beautiful examples. They had a process for everything. Things get ultimately done. They don't get done necessarily lickety split. They get done though. And there's records for everything. So I take that for granted. I'm working in a private company now and having to build all that.
Yeah, I've run, and again, there's positive things about bureaucracy and structure, and there's negative things about it. And what rhetoric always calls you back to is what's effective here and what is getting in the way of you being effective. And if you can run those all the time as software that's always going back and constantly recleaning what you're doing, you've got a pretty strong orientation that keeps you from making mistakes. You know, they won't let rhetorical critics and theorists will not let you believe things, no matter how comfortable they make you. Yeah. It's like if you let a rhetorician into the process, they're going to constantly challenge every single thing that everybody thinks. And you can't let that kill the process and slow it down, but man, it'll keep a clean process.
You're reassuring me for my area of study. Like you're giving voice to the questions that I'm always asking internally. And it's literally, it trained me in a way of thinking that allows things to get done. And I've always, struggled with that. Like, how do I articulate my rhetoric degree? And I think you just did it beautifully with those two questions of the utility in a business setting or a consulting setting, team setting, with those two beautiful questions.
And I think business ends up with good, like good enough often becomes the mantra in business that they,
yes.
Like, I don't have any more time. It's good enough. Let's move. And I'm like, that's not where you want to be. You want to be at good. I don't care. Like, I'm not here to drag you out and make you spend a billion hours with me to work on this over and over again, the way that a real rhetorician would.
Yeah.
The way like a comedy writer does. I love reworking comedy bits. I've got bits that I've written 200-300 punchlines for. The same bit, just because it's so much fun to write it. Like I have a bit about people snoring and what it sounds like if you sleep with somebody who snores. You're just laying there going, what is that? Is that somebody sucking frogs into a wet vac? Like, is that crows shooting porn? What is going on next to me? And I just like writing the punchline. So sometimes for fun.
It works in our business as well. We do a lot of public safety planning, and folks want it done, and those take time to develop. And so one thing that you don't want with safety is good enough.
Right.
And so we're always dealing with that. Not always. There are some people who, plan appropriately. Most humans don't though. And so, yeah, we want things quick. I'm guilty of it myself as a, you know, running a company and wanting things done quickly, and I have settled for good enough. And it's a reminder first is to define what good looks like. I love starting projects without defining what good looks like and then realizing, shit, I need to define that. So
yeah,
it's really, really important.
Well, that's a very, you know, interesting area to me too, the emergency stuff. I think I'm going to hold it off. We'll do a second podcast at some point, because, you know, we're deep into this idea of what a rhetoric degree does and what a rhetoric orientation does for somebody like you, who got interested in it and you've absorbed it and you've applied it in an academic way. And you have this strong orientation to also turn it into the war, you know, into something used by the world. And that was probably like balancing those things between the academics over here and doing all their stuff and going out to these communities. Talk about that a little bit. That must have been a, like, cause you're bridging both those worlds of the community. It's not, they're not used to getting any of this stuff in an organized way.
No, they used to call us like the white swan. Like, they couldn't believe that we were there. Like, how did you get here? And to back up a little bit, it started when I first learned about communication. I was like, oh my gosh, everyone needs to learn about this. And so I was constantly seeking opportunities to use it, because I'm a firm believer that if I'm learning something, I need to teach it to others or like use it in my life to, so it becomes a part of me. So I worked at a composting group, you know, trying to overhaul their educational material. I chaired a committee, the Environmental Service Committee, which was a committee comprised of faculty, staff, and students who had a pot of money, and their job was to dish that money out for environmental improvement projects. So I got in fights with the university president, their finance person, you know, geography professors, because they don't get, you know, rhetoric or communication.
Keep talking.
Yeah. So we oversaw the, you know, the overhaul of the website or application process, all that good stuff. So it started early in college, meaning like I needed to get this stuff out. When I was at IC Squared, that really had prepared me to go, you know, talk to people. Really, that's what communication is about, is how do I strike up a conversation and then discover what their needs are. And so bridging that gap was fun. There were some challenges, because I learned, Dan, that it's really hard to sell research.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
You know, people don't really get what they're going to get out of it, and they need something today because their community's struggling. So, you know, the first year and a half was just a lot of trips and learning, talking to people. And then I broke the cardinal research rule, is I'm, you know, providing consulting, because I want them to, their community to thrive today. Right. I don't want them to wait 6 to 8 months to get a paper that's going to describe what to do, that's anonymous and they're not going to read. So in the end, though, we designed some pretty cool programs. So we designed, I think, the first community accelerator program. So we took entrepreneurial kind of accelerators and incubator concepts and ran cities through them. So how do you teach cities to think entrepreneurially? And I guess the most impactful, this is literally how long it takes. The impactful experience I have is going to Sweden. So there's three communities in Northern Sweden that we have a relationship with for 8+ years, Luleå, Skellefteå, and Piteå. And they're one of the innovation capitals in the EU. They came over and learned IC Squared's method about 8 years ago, and then took that method and just put it on steroids. And so while we were developing all of our methodology, we went to Sweden. They invited us and said, hey, come look at what we're doing. And they were literally like, that was the model. And that's what I love about going to communities, is I get to see the model. You know, I called us the Pixar of academia. So anytime Pixar makes a movie, they go study the environments that they're trying to create. They go live in them. And so I'm in this ramble, what I'm getting at is what it taught me is to immerse myself in the areas that I'm studying or trying to learn. So they're learning as much as from me as I'm learning from them. And that's what I found for us to have success, is because we were there as an active participant to listen. You know, I had literally the coolest job. It was to go and eat the food and drink the beer and meet the people, and they called it research. So we were a gift to most communities because they were getting attention from a major, you know, university. And all the while we were learning just as much from them on what to do and what not to do to further one's economy and create more opportunity economically.
Did you take any cultural studies as part of your training?
No, just reading. So no formal cultural studies. I'm a firm believer in, like, most of the academic training that I got, it was kind of outdated, right? So the professors had found their flow and they're reteaching everything, which is great. You know, they've got their material.
Hey, they've been teaching it for 30 years. They better have their material down.
They've got it down. I was really lucky. Rebecca Fox, again, another, she's a rhetorician. She'd be great on your podcast. She was always out applying her research. So she's the one who got me into FIRE. She was working a lot in hospitals in the VA. She was my model of an applied rhetorician. But I read everything under the sun. So I read a lot of anthropology, biology, psychology, like, just give it to me all, because I have a deep need for intellectual curiosity. And I knew that there was something more going on than communication. I think communication, you know, everything is communication, is what, you know, my, you know, fellow colleagues in comp studies would say. And there's just so much more going on with us as humans. You know, there's anthropology, there's linguistics, that's why philosophy. So I got that on my own because I didn't get that need met in the classroom.
Well, and I think it does. That's one of the things I went to UT for my master's degree and then University of South Florida for my PhD. And South Florida was a new PhD program, and they had a really strong cultural studies professor who was young and had just started, and a really strong rhetorician who had worked with at UT Austin, who I've had on this podcast multiple times, David Payne. And then they had a really strong interpersonal guy who had been a quantitative giant in the field and then just threw it all over and didn't believe any of it anymore. And so was driving hard into narrative studies and qualitative studies, named Art Bochner. And so it was this really cool, they were the only three guys I took courses from, but I got a bunch of cultural studies, a bunch of qualitative interpersonal, and a bunch of rhetoric. And it's exactly what you're talking about, this idea of the phenomenological experience of a culture infusing and training the rhetoric. Like, so many people want to apply, again, mechanical rhetoric techniques, which have been around forever, but they don't understand how to adjust those down into the deep pico level experience of a culture. So that they resonate for real. And I run into this a lot with talking to the right and the American right. The left doesn't know how to talk to the right. I'm like, well, I grew up in Kentucky and I know this culture very well. I learned how to do stand-up comedy in biker bars in Florida. I know this world and I can talk to those people without making them mad. That's why I talk about sometimes I can do conversion and I've built systems behind this. Like, if you want to talk into that culture, understand that culture. And then you can adjust your rhetoric so that it will actually work, as opposed to get just frustrating you and you yelling that they're stupid. And, right, you know, I don't care if they are stupid. Well, you need to learn how to talk to stupid people. They vote.
It's a real skill to talk to stupid people. Well, one, that's a perfect blend to make a stand-up comedian, by the way, of those three areas of study. I couldn't think of a better mix to you know, thrust you into comedy writing. And for me, what comes up as I was hearing you tell that story is I grew up Mexican and Jewish. So I was raised Jewish. My dad was Mexican. And so that was just, I learned how to become a chameleon because it was just strange. It was Shabbat dinner on Friday. I'm fine China. There's a backyard barbecue on Saturday with pit bulls in the backyard. And I'm just like, whoa, I don't, and I'm, you know, the brown kid going to religious school and not enjoying learning Hebrew. So I was always an observer of culture. And I think that's ultimately, I think what we're getting at is to be a skilled rhetorician. And I believe that one has to be an observer of culture. And I believe you're exactly right. Liberal beliefs, and one of the things I learned in grad school is that the right, really struggles with their messaging. And I also felt that I was in grad school with the language police, so I couldn't say anything that would indicate that, you know, that would be the case. So
and I think, you know, having a more, that's my part of the pitch of this project, is having a more sophisticated understanding of your targets, sophisticated understanding of what it takes to be able to communicate with those people. If you want them to change, that's perfectly fine. Every human being wants other human beings to change. Right. That is the foundational learning, you know, principle of all of rhetoric, is that you cannot live as a human being without forcing other people to do different things or trying to get them to do different things for you. That's fine. Now figure out how to do it so that it's actually effective. Otherwise, be quiet, because you're just getting in the way.
And rhetoric doesn't necessarily teach, or didn't really teach me, I discovered it through communication studies, the sheer power of listening and empathy. And so rhetoric, you know, a lot of it was, some people have images of attacking and persuasion and
That's one part. That's one way of doing it. Yeah.
And so there's more nuanced ways, you know, as I've grown, and now I'm into nonviolent communication and just furthering my studies and just the art and the skill of communication, there's so many beautiful tactics that we can use to connect with each other. And really, that's for me what it comes down to, is how can I, you know, be present and connected with this individual regardless of their political belief system. And honestly, Dan, it really becomes quite simple to change a belief once I hear their perception and, you know, how they came to that. Then I have more choices as a rhetor about what I want to use strategically. And sometimes it's best to just say, no, thank you.
I talk about this in my book that I wrote during the freeze in Texas last year, the 21 Colosseums of Rhetoric book, that when you really get trained in the menu of persuasion and all the different options for coming towards people or working with people to get them to change the way they think and feel and do, you sort of are agnostic about technique. You don't need to battle with somebody. If you know you can get where you want by listening and being compassionate and empathetic, you know, then fine, use that.
Right.
The whole idea of rhetoric, the tradition of rhetoric as debate and aggressive persuasion, all that, I get it, it's fine, but it doesn't really work very well. Like in political arguments, that's why I have a certain process that I teach people in political conversions. Like, it goes through three stages, really. It's information gathered. Like, I just need to hear you. I need to hear you talk about what you believe and why and how your grandfather, you know, believed this. Like, I have a friend from South Africa, and, you know, I was talking to him about the whole South African racial tradition. He's like, yeah, I get it. He goes, but when I grew up, like, we had a plantation, and my grandfather, I saw him knock a black guy off the roof for mouthing at him, because that's what I grew up in. And you start to understand the depth and complexity of that, you know, that experience, and you can go, oh, I see why you're having a hard time getting to this new belief. So you gather enough information and you concentrate on creating a relationship. Nobody wants a relationship with somebody who's challenging everything they say and criticizing everything that you know, they believe.
That made dating for me really hard, by the way, you know? While learning rhetoric. Yeah, not an effective dating strategy.
No, you can't. You can't challenge. And so that's one of the things when I do conversions with the right, is I don't challenge them. Everybody wants to challenge, like, their beliefs are wrong, you know, and I'm like, or they don't, you know, they're believing something that's untrue. I'm like, I don't care. I need a relationship with them. Once I know who they are and I have a relationship, then I can start thinking, okay, well, where can we start dialoguing? And I can take you through a process, but only after they trust me and know me.
Yeah.
So, you know, stop being what I call an expressive rhetorician, which is you want to say things this way. I don't care what you want. As a rhetorician, it's the target. You know, they determine the tactic.
Well, we're literally hardwired. That's the beauty of, you know, my studies in cognitive psychology, is it lights up areas of our brain. It's like the same as eating, I believe, when we're speaking. So we're getting high off our own words. So that, like, the rhetoric, it feels good. And, like, you know, I think that I'm going to persuade you with my words. At the same time, I'm enjoying it so much because I'm getting high off of it. So
there's all sorts of weird stuff going on underneath that. But I tell people all the time, like, rhetoric is not a glamorous activity. It's not, it's a grind. This is a grinder occupation. You know, it's not, oh, I said the perfect thing and the whole world opened up and changed. No. I said tiny little things 500 times over 2 years. And then I got a little bit of light in this person's eyes.
Like, people don't realize. Yeah. And I mean, we deal with it a lot at work. I literally got hired because of my communication and rhetoric background. So like word choice is so vital. You know, one word in an email can make or break it. And people think that we're like nitpicking. And to your point, it's because we've done it. I've done it so many times that I can just tell you that your message isn't going to be well received. That it is a constant grind, and it makes writing not necessarily fun all the time, because sometimes I just want to get it out quickly. I'm also curious, as you're talking about your process, what are some of your favorite rhetorical strategies that you employ or teach people?
I do a lot of what I would call, I guess, soft persuasion. Like I sometimes call it, I have a term for it, soft suasion or light suasion, like no challenge. When I challenge people, I do it with comedy. I send a lot of meta signals of I'm enjoying this. You know, I think you're an interesting person. You know, believe whatever you want to believe. I don't care. It's all good. So I do a lot of meta signaling, and that's all relationship building from comm studies. And that means you smile a lot. You have a friendly tone. You act interested, and you are interested. These aren't, you know, the more authentic you are in your communication, the more powerful it is. And that I don't care. I don't judge people for what they believe. What I end up doing then on top of that, I come back on the second level of, because you're a trained rhetorician, especially with a PhD, they allow you to be the expert on rhetoric. They can't, there are certain things they cannot challenge. They want to, but they can't. And so I'm like, well, this is what I study for a living. I have a PhD in rhetoric. Do you want to hear some of that? And they're like, you know, I'm like, I'm not going to hurt you with it. I promise.
Yeah. I think most adults have a need or desire to learn. And I think, you know, the doctor, the PhD in rhetoric is a huge, let's call it advantage, as you set up the schools and the training programs. I mean, it's really, really popular right now. There's so many people creating all these online courses that are wonderful, that are supplementing, you know, traditional education, that I can take in an hour or 2 hours and quickly apply something. So,
well, I think that's the thing about being a resource for people. Like, I don't say, look, hey, I can dominate you, which I used to start my persuasion courses with, hey, okay, you know, welcome to the class. Anybody wants to argue with me, fine, you will lose. Because I've been doing this for 30 years. You're going to lose, but it's okay. You know, then you'll learn those techniques didn't work, and you'll come back and try the others, and those will lose. And, you know, you'll continue to lose, but you keep picking up techniques every time you do that. But I don't approach the world that way, where because I know technique, I can dominate you. I'm like, I know technique. I'm a great, great resource for you to figure out how to get things you want into the world. Like, if it's a super important for you to, you know, Christianize the world, according to your definition of that, great. Use rhetoric, but use ethical only rhetoric is the only thing I will take a stand on and be like, I don't, using unethical techniques destroys cultures, communities, relationships, lives, leads to violence, all this stuff. So try to stay ethical.
So well said and beautiful. Yeah, that again, it goes back to Dr. Fox. You know, she didn't know who she was training, right? The next, you know, leaders or evildoers. You can really go either way with rhetoric, and just kind of hope for the best as you put these tools out there.
Well, cool, man. I really appreciate you jumping on today. We're over an hour. I won't keep you the rest of the day. Like every time I talk to somebody who's got a background in rhetoric, it just goes on and on and on and on. There's so much to talk about.
I loved it, Dan. This was a true delight and pleasure. And thank you for sharing more about you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we'll circle back around and talk about the emergency services company, because I we talked about that before we did this podcast, and fascinating, so many issues there. So really cool stuff. Anything you need to promote or you'd like to tell people to follow you on something? Or
I'm working on, you know, getting some writing out there. So perhaps follow me on LinkedIn a little bit. Check out Code 4. We're doing some really cool work in the public safety world and keeping people safe at concerts, music festivals, and moving into government work. So I look forward to a discussion about that someday.
Yeah, absolutely. We will definitely circle back around. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Always fun. I love it when rhetoricians jump on here and just share their background and things that they've drugged the rhetorical apparatus through. Like, I drug it over here and then I was in Sweden. I was like, what? That's great. So super fun. I appreciate it, Jonathan. Get out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it.
Thanks, Dan.